Hi there, and welcome to the third episode of Expat Chat. James, I think it's pretty safe to say that we've been pretty blown away with the feedback, and we were originally planning on doing these twice a month, and this is our third one in 3 weeks. But yeah, the feedback's been coming through thick and fast. So thank you very much for all the questions and queries that everyone's had, and also just the nods to us. That's been keep it up. So it gives us the motivation to keep going again. So just a couple of housekeeping issues for those on the podcast. Sincerely appreciate it if you could subscribe to the channel, give us a rating, and also to write some reviews. You know, those reviews not only help us do a better job, but it also helps other expats find the podcast. So that's a great thing. For those watching on YouTube, please hit that subscribe button and also give us some commentary in the comments. Because once again, it's that sort of feedback. We know what direction to take this in, and all we want to do at the end of the day is provide value to expats. So
that's right.
You know, it's a big thing for us. So thank you once again, and let's get the show on the road. So,
well, Brett, before we jump into it, we should have a disclaimer.
Yes.
So obviously,
that's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, do not take this as personal advice. It's general advice only. We're not actually providing advice to your specific situation. Obviously, seek a professional advice from an individual that is actually qualified, whether it be qualified tax accountant or a qualified financial planner.
Yep, definitely.
So not personal advice.
Yep, fantastic. Happy International Women's Day. Today's a pretty auspicious day for half the population out there, which is fantastic. So
yeah, that's right.
Certainly as a father of two daughters, and it's great to see a lot of the things. You know, we decided to look at the data that we grabbed from the Expat Insights survey last year, and come up with some pretty interesting facts, actually. So just to run through some of those, over 60% of Australian expat females are actually holding a bachelor or a postgraduate degree. So they're smart cookies, which is fantastic. Motivation for going overseas appears that the adventure streak runs just as strongly with females and males, with 24% of Australian women moving overseas to find a new challenge, which is great. So the world is a big place, and we always encourage people to go out there and experience it, and certainly looks like the ladies are taking that on board. The next two most popular ones were certainly the issue of inter-citizen marriages. Mm. So, we had a lot of responses there. 19% of people moving overseas because they had a foreign citizen as a spouse or partner. And the last one was 16% of Australian women moved overseas because their partner accepted a role.
Yeah.
So
relocating the whole family.
Relocating the whole family, exactly. So picking up the whole lot and moving them across. So it's always interesting to find out the method or the motivations behind the screens anyway.
Absolutely.
Destination-wise, this probably didn't come as a surprise.
No.
The top two countries were the United States at 26% and the United Kingdom at 16.47%. And followed after that were Canada, France, and the United Arab Emirates.
France actually surprised me there.
Well, I guess there's a lot of Francophiles in the Australian expat community. And, but, I think also too, the French, when you look at their main sectors of work, there is a lot of those areas that, do correlate well with the roles that Australian women are working in Australia too.
Yep.
So if we go through and look at the employment side, I think the three most popular sectors were education at 22%, and then followed that by the healthcare sector at 12%, and then the hospitality sector at 9%. Mm. So, when you think of France, all of those sort of sectors do correlate quite well, and we've probably got a bit of that as well. It'd actually be interesting to go, and one time when we've got a bit of spare time, to actually delve in deeper and see what specific sectors, Australian expat women are actually working in the United States, in the UK, in Canada.
And it'd be great to forecast the growth in those sectors of women as well, as they slowly take over the world.
Definitely.
So it'd be very interesting to see, obviously, the percentage changes year to year.
Yep.
And I think we're going to grab some great data this year.
Yeah.
After the 2019 Insights survey is actually wrapped up.
No, well, that's the whole point of doing these surveys every year, so we can track the movements and see what countries are becoming more popular, what countries are becoming less popular. More males than females moving to specific countries, jobs, the whole gamut of information. And the great thing about, and I want to say thank you very much to everyone out there for participating, for those who have. If you haven't participated in the this year's survey yet, We're going to leave a link in the description on YouTube and also in the show notes for the podcast of where you can go. Right now, I haven't told James this yet, we're almost going through 1,670 responses from 81 countries.
Jeez.
81. Yeah. So it's pretty crazy. We had two from Iraq last week, which is pretty cool. So we haven't had anyone from Iraq yet. So for those in Iraq, thank you very much. And the interesting part is, last year when we ran the survey, we got 1,774 responses over the whole survey.
Yeah.
What are we, two and a bit months? Oh, yeah, month and a bit in.
Yeah.
And we're about to go through the numbers we exceeded last year. So,
which is amazing.
It's amazing, and it just goes to show, you know, that, I mean, we would love to offer prizes, we would love to offer incentives to complete the surveys, but unfortunately, the rules and regulations state that we'd have to actually register as a lottery or as a prize in 81 countries.
Yeah.
And while we do financial planning for expats very well, when it comes to the navigating the government corridors, we'll leave that to someone else. So all we're doing is appealing to, I guess, that Aussie mateship, you know, help an expat out, because those who do benefit from the survey are not only those who are about to move overseas and want a more of an idea, like a coalface type of opinion of what it's like in that country.
Yes.
But also too, for other expats who are already overseas moving to a different country.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, the data helps us when it comes to lobbying Canberra. Mm-hmm. There's a grossly incorrect assumption of who an expat is. I think they think them all as high-flying executives on seven-figure salaries.
No, but it's just a common Australian. Also,
no, exactly.
I mean, the fact that an example of that is some of the figures you just rattled off then about the stats about how there's such a large proportion of females in the education industry. So these are just teachers, international schools, you know, nothing out of the ordinary.
Teachers, nurses, working in hotels, you know, no different to Sydney versus Shanghai.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
right.
And that's the, you know, I think that what we see and we hear from our clients is the angst that they go through. Mm. Like, you know, they read in the press the government's opinion on what an expat is.
Mm.
But it probably only applies to 1% of the expat community.
Yeah, much like the population.
Bingo.
The 1%ers. Yeah, exactly.
It is.
Right. Yeah.
It is. So, you know, certainly the data from the surveys does help us trying to right those wrongs with Canberra's opinion.
Mm.
So please definitely continue to, you know, provide feedback, because it's all that information. We're not making it up. You know, we have the data at hand. We can go to the, you know, go to Canberra and say, guys, you know, you want to do this, this is who it's going to affect.
Mm, exactly.
It's not going to affect who you think it's going to affect. And certainly we've been using last year's data to try to convince Canberra not to go ahead with the main residence exemption changes, because they're not going to affect the big end of town.
Yeah.
They're going to affect, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So,
yeah, that's right. And I mean, just on that, I think they think by introducing this piece of legislation, it's going to have expats running to the market to sell.
Mm.
They introduce this, if anything, it's going to discourage them to sell.
That's right.
They'll likely hold on to it until they come back to Australia, where
yep.
it's likely that the old rules will still apply to them. But obviously, if they've rented out past the 6 years, you know, we know CGT will start attracting. So it's not going to have the impact that they want it to have at all.
And look, judging by that commentary we saw from the Treasury officials the other day,
yes.
You know, when very plain questions were asked of them, and they said, oh, that's an ATO question.
Yeah.
They didn't even know what the ramifications were.
Didn't even know how to answer it,
yeah.
which is ridiculous. I mean,
doesn't give any confidence at all. I know, exactly. So, yeah.
But anyway, let's jump in.
Yeah, definitely.
Today's agenda, a few things. So I'm going to touch base on common reporting standards.
Yep.
Deemed disposal. I've had a few inquiries the last few weeks, and I want to, I suppose, go through and brush up on it, just let everyone know what it is. Because if you don't know what it is, you can use it and it can save you thousands in tax, as we know. Non-residency, but around self-managed super fund, and just what to be aware of there. Briefly touch base on the opposition's announcements of what they want to abolish and get rid of.
Yep.
And then lastly, Q&A.
Q&A, so, yep. Now we've got a lot of questions, so looking forward to running those through. And once again, if you do have questions, there's a lot of avenues you can ask them. Head to our Facebook page, Atlas Wealth Management. Certainly hit us message up on there through Twitter. You can use the hashtag expatchat or ask Atlas.
Yep.
Or just drop us an email at info@atlaswealth.com.au, and more than happy to bring them up on the channel and discuss them at length. So
that's why we're here.
Yep.
So Brett, what is common reporting standards? Give me a rundown.
the Common Reporting Standard is essentially a unilateral effort by governments around the world to share data.
Yeah. Okay.
So in the past, we've always heard of the tax havens like British Virgin Islands, Panama. We all know what happened with Panama.
Yep.
You know, all these nice little Switzerlands, you know, those are the historical one. And essentially what it is a data sharing agreement amongst over 100 countries and territories.
Okay. Yep.
So what it means is if you're an expat based in, say, UK or Denmark, then when the local, say, we'll talk about UK, when the HMRC finds out you're an Australian expat,
yes,
they will ask your banks and your financial institutions to provide your Australian tax file number.
Yeah, okay.
We know internationally it's called a TIN, a tax identification number.
Yep.
And essentially the way it works is these guys will then take that information and pass it straight to the ATO.
Yep.
So if you've got money hiding anywhere in these 100 signatory countries, the ATO will know about it.
Yeah.
And years gone by, an expat could hide overseas.
Yeah, of course.
The information, the technology, the agreements weren't there.
Well, data, yeah, the data sharing wasn't even there. Even the data feeds, the tech wasn't there.
The tech wasn't there. That, that's right. There's no function to share.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's amazing, you know, how interrelated the government's connectivity is, not only domestically, but also internationally. I mean, I got a letter the other day, which proved the point. So I moved house, as you know, a couple of months ago. And I got a letter from the Australian Electoral Commission to say that a government agency had notified them of a change of address.
Just want to make sure you're going to vote, Brett.
Well, and all I did was I changed the address of my driver's license. That's all I've got around to doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
But just goes to show that internally, everyone's talking.
Yeah.
Same as occurring internationally. And a lot of the, you know, those people listening and viewing, you may have got notifications either online or in letter form from the banks,
banks
asking where you're domiciled. And once they've got that, what it means is you will say, I'm domiciled in the UK.
Mm.
Then that bank flags that and then knows to pass that to the HMRC.
Yeah.
So the world is becoming a very small place for expats.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I think a lot of people get scared about data sharing and like, okay, well, if they know about it, does that mean they want a tax bill? I mean, it's mainly about reporting. It's just it making sure that they know you have it and that's it. I mean, we know with the IRS, it's not necessarily about the tax side. Mm. It's mainly about the reporting side. If you don't report it, you actually get fined. And that's what actually scares, you know, the crap out of people.
Yep. Well, so this is actually the funny thing, because the only major country that hasn't signed up to FATCA, signed up to the Common Reporting Standard, is the United States.
Do as I say.
So you've heard it from here. If you want to hide money anywhere around the world, hide it in the US. Give it to Donald. He'll look after it for you, trust me.
That's bizarre. But one thing you just mentioned there, FATCA. So does that interlink with CRS? Or?
So FATCA is the reverse to the CRS. Okay. So the CRS means that by law, all these countries have to share data in the signatory countries.
Okay, yep.
FATCA is an agreement that the US has with individual countries that they must share information back to the US.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a great case of do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, okay.
As part of that FATCA agreement, the US can share data with the Australian authorities, but they don't have to. And reading between the lines, when you go through and look at the legislation, I don't encourage anyone to look at it.
Yep.
Virtually what it says is, if there's criminal proceedings and those sort of things, we will share it.
Yeah.
But apart from that,
no. No chance.
No chance. Oh, so there's actually been a massive repatriation of capital back into the US. That's quite smart by them.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to hide money in the world, just buy something in the US.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's
very unusual.
Just a big warning, because the ATO will know more about you.
Mm.
And we'll talk about the HECS and help debt situation, because this is where it's going to really tie into that. So,
yeah.
You know, because they've virtually got to know, you say I earned X, and your local tax agency in the country you live in says you earn Y, the ATO can come back to you and say, hey, no, you're wrong.
We know this. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a good segue. I didn't actually put it on today's agenda, but HECS.
Yep.
So HECS repayments when you're a non-resident.
Yep.
We know that they're compulsory now. And
still meeting people who don't know anything about it. I was talking to a lady in Bahrain 3 days ago.
Okay, yep.
And sort of knew something about it, but didn't have a clue. So just to run through to the viewers and the listeners, one July, you have to report your overseas global gross income to the ATO.
Yep.
Do that two ways. You can either do it through an accountant or through the my.gov expatchat.com.au website.
Yep.
The problem is A, most don't know about it.
No.
And B, there's a lot of confusion as to what you have to disclose. So quickly running through it, you know, the threshold is about 54,136.
Yeah, I think, but it's actually about to change. It's dropping down to 45 now.
Yes.
I think if you're over 45, or if you're in that first tier, 45 and
it's 1%
of your income.
Yeah, and then above 54, it's 4%. The problem is people assume that A, they earn below that, and then they work out, if especially if they're earning US dollars, the US Australian dollar's fallen a lot.
Yes.
So suddenly they're getting bumped up into
first category.
Yeah. And when you do the declaration, you have to go off a standardized average on the ATO website that actually says you can't pick the best exchange rate at the time. You have to actually take our exchange rate, which is a combination of 12 months worth of exchange rates, and I'll average it out.
Okay.
So people saying, oh, I'm fine, because they worked it out on the back of a cornflakes packet when the exchange rate was good. But now the exchange rate is bad from an Australian point of view, so that could push them up.
Yep.
Even if you weren't above the threshold, you still have to report.
Yep.
And you know, I think it's called a non-disclosure report. I can't remember the exact verbiage, and I'll put a link to an article we wrote in the show notes and also in the description below. With those notes, with that declaration, there's virtually two declarations you have to make underneath the threshold. The first one is saying, look, I earn, I think it's about $14,000. I'm good.
Yeah.
The other one says, I am between 14 and the lower threshold.
Yeah.
I'm still okay, but I'm just letting you know this.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the other one's above that again. So, you know, I know met a lot of people who haven't actually made any declarations regardless of that. So, certainly talking to people, you know, over the last couple of weeks saying, look, this is coming up, and they're what's coming up?
ATO is going to start clamping down on this because ATO wants to get paid back its money. If you don't disclose, then they're happy to fine you $500. They've got no issue with fining. So yeah, obviously get your disclosures in. But just on talking about declaring the worldwide income, you know, if you're going through an accountant, the accountant can use three methods. So there's obviously the simple method where you just like, this is my income, this is my proof of it. They'll go and lodge it. If you don't really have any deductions, then they can use, I suppose, a standardized method where, based on your industry, your job role, they can apply a standard worldwide deduction to your income to bring it down a tiny bit.
Yep.
And then the next method is the complex and comprehensive method where, if you've got, say, a property that's needed to give back in Australia, they'll just essentially compensate everything like they're lodging a tax return.
Yep.
And then based on that net income amount, that's obviously, you know,
will
fall into the tier. So there's three methods you can use. I mean, if you've got bits and pieces, it's obviously more beneficial to go the complex method if you've got some, you know, relevant deductions. But start lodging, because otherwise you're just going to get fined.
Yep. And that's where it's, I remember reading an article that the ATO was pointing out that a non-disclosure can cost you up to 75% penalties of the amount of tax owed.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I'll see if I can find that for you guys and also put it in the description in the show notes. But, you know, it's gone from it's good to, you know, pay off your hex debt to you have to pay off your hex debt.
Yeah.
And if you don't, it's going to cost you a lot more money.
Yeah. And I guess to those people, Bahrain being one of them, all in these tax-free zones, you know, Middle East, the Gulf, part of the GCC countries, it's going to come as actually a bit of a rude shock, to be honest, because if they're on good income and the ATO wants a 7% repayment, that's, I think, the highest here, or 10%.
No, it's up to 10 now.
Yeah, so 10% of, say, you know, you're making 300,000 and you've still got a fair bit of hex there because, you know, you're a lawyer or whatever, that's a rude shock.
And the other thing, too, that it causes a lot of confusion, it's 10% of your salary.
It's not the hex debt.
Not at the hex debt.
Not at the hex debt.
So people go, oh, I've got $50,000 hex debt, but I've got a $200,000 salary.
Yeah.
They go, oh, 10% at 50, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, you're not paying $5,000.
No, no, not at all.
You know, so...
the income. Yeah, you're, that's right. You're spot on, actually. I think a few months ago, someone's like, oh, it's only, you know, I've only got this left, so I'm only going to have to pay back, you know, probably $1,500. I was like, this year, you're paying back the full amount.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're spot on that. It's something that people are not aware.
They don't, and they get caught all the time. And I think, you know, just spending a bit of time, get on the front foot, putting a bit of money away on a monthly basis.
Yeah, that's right.
That, it's the easiest way to solve it. You know roughly, you know, and we'll also put the thresholds in the show notes and the description as well. It's very easy to see roughly where you're going to be.
Yep.
and you know what your salary is.
Yep.
So just make a quick calculation. Say, rightio, I'm going to need to pay back $10,000 this year. Divide that by 12 and put that away.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, one thing people don't understand and realize is that, let's say you do the hex lodgement, the ATO says, listen, we want 10,000, we want it now. You can actually put yourself on a payment plan where if you're using an accountant, that's fine. If you're using the online MyGov system, they require a minimum of 10% down payment on that. And then you can put yourself on a payment plan over the next few months.
Yep.
So if it's a case where your cash flow is short at the moment, you can always do that. So
yep.
Don't stress too much. But if you don't pay at all, don't let the ATO know, then it's likely they'll put general interest charges on it.
That's right.
Probably, you know, why not fine you at the same time?
Yeah.
So just all these things in the background that can still go wrong.
And those interest charges aren't at the same rate as a mortgage.
Not at all.
They're a lot higher.
Or I think they range between 9 and 11%.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it's ridiculous. A lot of money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, but and that can apply to even land tax and everything like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's another fine.
No, it is. It is.
Anyways, Brett, let's move on to deemed disposal.
Yep.
I mean, it's shocking how often I come across an inquiry, a consult, and I mention deemed disposal.
It's weekly. Oh, almost daily.
Well, it is daily.
Yeah.
And the fact that even those people's accounts don't mention it to them, it's almost like the accounts even don't even know about it. And it's probably because they're not providing advice to internationals very often or expats very often. So why would it be in their repertoire?
Goes back to episode 2 when we talked about picking the right advisor and right accountant, someone who's match fit in the industry, because this stuff is it's like picking up a rock to us. It's easy.
I'll run you through a hypothetical that I had this week, and I feel terrible for the bloke, but it is what it is. So deemed disposal is essentially a capital gains tax event that you crystallize when you leave Australia. So hypothetically, if I'm leaving at the start of April and I'm holding a share portfolio, because it only applies to non-taxable Australian property, so that's shares,
managed funds, ETFs, listed investment companies.
Spot on. So you can only do it on those type of assets. And essentially what it means is the day that you leave Australia, you're saying to the ATO, I'm selling these assets.
On paper. Yep.
If I'm making a gain, you will have to pay some capital gains tax. If I'm making a capital loss, you'll get the benefit of carrying forward that capital loss. It then means that no further capital gains tax is going to accrue on the growth of that asset. Now, let me paint a picture for you. I work for a tech company here in Australia. I've been invested thousands of shares over a 10-year period. I leave Australia. I ask my accountant, is there anything I need to do about these shares? Or, you know, the accountant, not being experienced in that situation, just says, no, they'll just keep growing. You don't need to sell them. It's fine, you know. You know, you can look at selling when you're overseas or when you come back, but normal capital gains tax will apply. I then find out 7 months later, after my tax return's already been lodged, about deemed disposal. The shares have done an IPO. I've had all these rights, so I've executed them.
Yep.
I've made a huge capital gain. Now, because I didn't do deemed disposal on the shares I was already holding, that capital gain is now taxable. If I sell the portfolio down, it's taxable at non-resident marginal tax rates.
Which, no tax-free threshold,
nothing.
32.5 cents in the first dollar.
If I want to hold that share portfolio whilst I'm over as a non-resident, I can't even apply the 50% CGT discount method for the period that I hold as a non-resident. If that keeps going up to several million dollars, that's a huge CGT event that I've got, and I can't get out of it.
And look, it's amazing how I would say 8 out of every 10 people that we meet who have some sort of shares outside of super haven't heard of this.
No.
And sometimes you get lucky where they might hold a poor performing stock in their portfolio.
Yes.
That can offset some of the CGT that is liable when you do the deemed disposal.
Yeah, absolutely.
But as a classic case in point, when you own something that's $50 a share, yes, there's a bit of pain, but if that $50 share goes to $250 a share, that's all tax-free.
Absolutely.
Now, it could be a potential double bunger, and I'll throw the US applications here as well.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. If you were to sell those shares, you're in tech, so more than likely you'd be in San Fran.
Mm-hmm.
If you were in San Francisco and you were to sell those shares, not only would you owe the ATO a truckload, but a governor at the California state is going to put his hand up for California state tax as well.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's something you don't want to have to deal with.
No.
You know, you want, okay, yes, the, you know, California state tax their bit, but not on top of the ATO.
No.
So suddenly you've gone from making a great gain to now paying out probably potentially over half of the portfolio in just in capital gains tax.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, look, a deemed disposal is incredibly important for a lot of people because these days it's very common for people to build a small investment portfolio, shares, managed funds, ETFs. That's so easy to buy these days.
Yep.
But they don't realise that if they were just to take the proper time before they moved overseas to sell these on paper, pay the capital gains tax at that point, then all depending what jurisdiction you're in, but from an Australian point of view, you don't owe the ATO any capital gains tax on that growth.
Not at all.
And, you know, it's a... To me, it's that side of it. Cash is also a big part as well.
Yeah.
You know, people are nervous about moving cash around.
Yeah.
And we did have this question, which we'll go into, you know, towards the end. But, you know, it's amazing how either people just don't have a clue or they've heard other myths about what may happen to it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we'll hopefully, you know, answer some of those ones down the track as well too.
Yeah, exactly right. And just, I mean, just to finish off on the deemed disposal side, you know, if you're doing deemed disposal, yep, great. The shares go up in value. If you're not crystallizing any capital gains events, you're not making a tax event on that portfolio in your other domicile. And then when you come back to Australia, that's when your cost base will essentially reset on those shares. You can still hold on to them. That's great. When you re-enter, usually the closing prices of that day, that'll start form the cost base going forward. And that's how you go about it. But just to be clear, if you've gone overseas and you haven't done deemed disposal, but you've lodged that final tax return, you can't go back and amend that.
No.
The reason why? Because obviously, you know, you're producing a quite a large financial benefit. You're gaining from your
situation. In going back in time, and you can't do that.
Yeah, exactly right. It'll trigger an audit with the ATO, and the ATO will just be like, uh-uh.
Yeah.
So you can't go back and audit those sort of, or amend those sort of things. So sometimes, yeah, obviously seeking advice with someone that's match fit, they've got clients that are expats, always the way to go.
And that is probably question number two that we ask people. You know, do you have any shares? You know, did you do deemed disposal? It's actually on our client profile form.
Yeah, it is. You're right.
You know, simple things like that. It's all these little things, like we said in episodes one and two, the little things done early and right gives you the best results. The ones that you hear the horror stories of expat stories are the ones who didn't seek advice and they've tried to go back in time.
Case an example.
Yeah.
The individual I spoke to earlier in the week, he worked for a tech company. Now the portfolio is worth a few million. Can't really sell it. If he sells it, he's going to get absolutely smashed by capital gains tax. You know, he could look to wind it down over a few years. That's probably the only way he can go.
Yep.
But now he's just sort of stuck.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what do you do? But I'll move on.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
Move on to next point of agenda. So a self-managed super fund, what is it first? Let's educate people quickly.
I think there's a lot of confusion out there about what an SMSF is.
Yep.
A self-managed super fund is a fund that not only are you the beneficiary of, but you're the trustee. Let's ignore the jargon. You're the one pulling the levers.
Yes, okay.
And we're not just talking about investment selection, but the actual compliance itself of the SMSF.
Yep.
So you're sitting there making sure that the investment strategy is up to date. You're making sure the audits are getting done. You're making sure, you know, the biggest problem we find, especially the last 5 years, is there's been this rush of people to get SMSFs. They're not sure why, but they get it.
Yep.
And then they don't realize that when they go overseas, the goalposts are in a completely different direction.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's pretty rare that you don't know. Like, you'll know if you have a self-managed super fund. I mean, you've got to do an annual tax return like you're running a business almost. So you know if you have a self-managed super fund, but when you leave Australia and you become a non-resident, you really need to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
And some things that I've come across in the last few weeks about other individuals holding SMSFs, I wanted to sort of touch base on it because it is a big issue.
So we're going into central management control.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So central management control is essentially, the central management control of a self-managed super fund needs to be maintained by a normal Australian tax resident at all times. Now, there is something called rubber stamping.
Mm-hmm.
A rubber stamping on a self-managed super fund is essentially, I'm a non-resident. I've got a self-managed super fund, but I know about central management control. So I know I'm not allowed to be the one pulling the strings on it anymore. I go over and contact my brother. I go, mate, I need to put you on my self-managed super fund. I know it's all my assets.
So he becomes the trustee.
He becomes the trustee. I've got a corporate trustee within it. So he becomes the director.
Yep.
POAs, everything. So On the surface, if the ATO looks at him, he's like, oh, no, he's a normal Australian tax resident, that's fine.
Yep.
This is compliant. But if they go to my brother and say, and they ask him questions about my SMSF, he doesn't know anything.
No.
He doesn't know what's going on.
Yep.
And that's what we call rubber stamping.
And we know that right now the ATO is actually going out to the trustees of self-managed super funds, not just for expats, but everyone in general.
Yeah, yeah.
To make sure and ensure that they understand what they're doing.
Exactly.
So if your brother were to get that correspondence from the ATO, what's he going to say?
He wouldn't know. He wouldn't know what to say.
Yeah.
And this is what's happening. There was a case, in example, I think it's tax determination 5/2018. And it made evident about rubber stamping where exact same case, SMSF existed. They put on their family members to act as obviously, you know, the trustees, the directors. They actually had no idea what was going on with the SMSF. And you could still see behind the scenes, they were still pulling the strings,
yep,
making the decisions. They found email threads to the accountants,
yep,
saying doing this. So essentially, the ATO was lucky in that the ATO gave them one opportunity to wind it up straight away. And it's very rare that it happens.
Yeah, usually it's like straight non-compliance.
Yeah, exactly. So usually what happens if they deem it to be non-compliant, you no longer get the tax concessions that a self-managed super fund has. So what that means is your tax rate of 15% is pulled off. They levy a new tax rate of 47%, and that's on the assets as well as the income. So you essentially lose half your balance straight away.
Half balance is gone. Yeah, it's an expensive exercise. And and I think the important distinction to make is too, is when you're appointing someone, you can't just tell your accountant or your financial planner, okay, you're it. We're talking about the overarching...
Yeah, everything.
You know, the hiring and firing of accountants and financial planners and the whole, you know... And I think the other important distinction too is regarding beneficial ownership inside of SMSFs.
Well, this is another thing the ATO looks at as one of its tests. So why would I be running... Or why would my brother be running my SMSF when he has not $1 in there?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
No.
And I think that's where a lot of people get caught up. It's like, yeah, listen, so I've taken care of that. I've nominated some other directors and stuff. And it's just like, well, that's just rubber stamping. That's a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
That's, you know, solving a problem for another problem later in life.
Exactly.
And it's usually a case that the other problem comes around in 12 months' time.
Yeah.
Just on that, though, I want to touch base on the temporary absence rule.
Yes, good one. Yep.
I think it's the two-year rule.
Two-year rule. Yep.
So if you're still coming back within a period of two years... they say that, listen, okay, we can see that you're only temporarily absent, therefore we're happy that central management control is still held by you.
Yeah.
But what's unusual about temporary absence rule, if on the surface, on the facts, that they can see that you're permanently gone, but you've had, due to some event overseas, you've had to come back, but it looks like you're going to be gone forever.
Mm.
Even if it's under 2 years, they'll say non-compliant.
Non-compliant. Yeah.
Because we can see, based on the facts, you were gone.
Yeah. You were severing all ties.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas sometimes it can go the other way. Oh, we can see that you're gone just for over 2 years, but we know that we realise there's an intention to come back.
Yeah, you own your property here, you won't rent to get out, all those sort of things, or your family might have been still in Australia. Or...
Exactly right. So they say, listen, we're happy for temporary absence rule to apply here, so it's still, you know, CMC's okay.
Yep.
So it's a very fine line, the temporary absence rule, and it just seems like it depends on what kind of mood the ATO is in.
And also, I think it goes to show, like we were talking about last week in episode 2 with the Harding case.
Yes.
You know, not every determination will apply to every single person.
No.
You know, it really comes down to your personal circumstances. Mm. And, you know, your neighbour could be an Australian as well.
Yeah.
But just because they got away with it doesn't mean you can.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of stuff that's under the hood that, you know, really comes into working out whether it's, you know, relevant or not. So.
Yeah, and as we touched base, hopefully the Board of Taxation comes up with some new residency rules and something easier.
183-day rule, wouldn't that be a nice little Christmas present? So.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could actually essentially become a non-resident quite easy.
Exactly.
But yeah, they're not going to make it that easy, let's be honest.
Yep, no, exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right.
All right, Brett, so that's self-managed super funds, non-residency, don't do it. That's my own advice.
Look, it's unless you're holding a physical asset that, you know...
Property. Yeah.
You know, that makes it very difficult. You can't sell a balcony off or those sort of things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that, you know, may not be the smartest idea to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Then you may hold it, but still, it's not a solution.
No.
It's a Band-Aid.
Yeah, exactly right. And then, I mean, if you're intending on going away for 3+ years, you shouldn't have a self-managed super fund.
Not at all, no.
You can't contribute to it while you're a non-resident because that breaches the active members test.
Yep.
There's a whole suite of tests, but... just don't do it.
No.
It's not worth it. If that's your retirement, losing 47% of it, it's not worth it.
Good advice.
Yeah. All right, well, Brett, let's move on. I want to touch base on opposition's proposal.
Yes, this is what Mr. Shorten's talking about in the lead up to the election.
Exactly right. So he's mentioned quite a lot of things. And
a laundry list.
It's a laundry list. And when I read through them, I was actually quite nervous for expats.
Because initially we thought, it shouldn't affect them too much. But when you go through and look at the detail...
When you look under the hood, I was like, shit,
okay. We've got five pages of stuff here, so...
Yeah, exactly right. So, first one I want to touch base on, which we mentioned briefly last week, was the negative gearing.
Yep.
So, as we know, they're looking to make a change to negative gearing. No idea what date they're going to set. It could be actually retrospectively. So, they could throw a date back as of the 1st of January 2019. And essentially, you will no longer be able to use negative gearing on secondhand properties to offset future wage income or anything like that. Secondhand properties can go against current investment income,
yep.
so from dividends and those sort of things. And if you want the benefit of carrying forward a net income loss, you will need to actually make sure that you buy a brand new property. So
off the plan.
Off the plan. Yep. Exactly right. Which is easy enough to understand, but when you've got a current property portfolio, there's not too much guidance on how that's going to be treated. And especially if you've got a few hundred thousand dollars worth of net income.
It is like grandfathering or those sort of things, yeah.
That's right. So they've announced that it's quite a scary rule because, as we know, Australians have a love affair with property. Expats, just the same.
Yep.
And I suppose that's where the MREs come from as well. That's one scary proposal.
So what's the scenario, Fred Smith moves to Dubai in 2020.
Yep.
These rules are enacted and enforced.
Yep.
He buys a secondhand property in Balmain.
Yep.
That is, for all intents and purposes, negative geared, e.g. the cash flow is negative.
Yeah.
With that amount that he's putting in out of his own pocket to top it up, that's money gone.
Or doesn't receive a tax benefit. He might get to segregate the net income losses on that property to apply to future investment income only.
Yep.
But if he's someone that's not interested in doing other investments, he's not going to get the benefit of it all.
Yeah.
So ideally, if you're doing the negative gearing scenario on secondhand property, you either have already another property that's positively geared.
Yep.
Or you've got other sources of income. So that, whether it be from other investments essentially. But other than that, that kind of strategy just doesn't work.
No. So virtually we could see a big change in the landscape of the Australian expat community here on that benefits of buying a property because they'll be paying money out of their own pocket.
For no reason. Yeah, no reason. Okay. That's as simple as it is.
Yep.
The next one that I want to talk about, non-concessional contribution cap.
Yes.
So at the moment, when we contribute to super, two types of caps.
We've got concessional, non-concessional.
Yep. So concessional, when we put it in, 15% contributions tax comes out, it's $25,000 a year. Non-concessional, treated as an after-tax contribution, goes in, no tax comes out of it, and at the moment it's $100,000 per year. So they're looking at reducing that to $75,000 per year. And then
they don't want people to put more money into super?
No, they want to tax it.
That's right.
What's happening. So it essentially means if you're triggering the bring forward rule, you can only put up to $225,000 rather than
$300,000.
So that's actually quite big. Especially if you're selling your house and you're wanting to get as much into super before you retire at 65 or whatever it might be. So a bit of an issue there, but just something that obviously Labor wants to get in. Yeah.
Look, and I think it's almost like seeing around a corner. You can see the government's focus is to reduce the ability to put money to super.
Yeah.
So if you do have plans or are an inkling of topping up your super account, more earlier than later.
Yeah.
Because just to explain a scenario, if the bring forward rule... Essentially, if you buy the age of 65 and you're working, you can put in 3 years worth of non-concessional contributions in one go.
Yep.
If they were to change that and your three-year rule straddles the change, so let's say, for example, you put in $300,000 on the 1st of July this year, triggering in the next two financial years, but they change the rules as of 1st of August, you've actually been pretty clever.
Yeah.
Because
we have, absolutely. Yeah.
So just consider those options, people, because it, in a landscape that is changing so quickly like Canberra is, we don't know what it's going to be in 12 months' time, let alone six.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And that moves me onto the next point where catch-up concessional contributions. So they're only effective as of this financial year. So catch-up concessional contributions state that we can accumulate our non-used concession contribution cap. So if I put in 10,000 this year, I can carry over 15,000
to the
next
year.
Yep. So that means next year I can put in 40,000.
40,000, yep.
And so on and so forth over a 5-year rolling period, as long as my superannuation balance is under 500,000.
Yep.
Now, Labor being the fun party that they are, they want to remove it straight away. So as of 1st of July 2019, if they get in, they're actually going to remove that rule, which means if you're saving up this year's concessional contribution
for next year
to offset a capital gain on shares, property, whatever it might be, you've just wasted a year that you haven't been able to get anything in for super.
Yep.
So it's another one. It's another pain point that I think mm-hmm. expats are going to feel, because the ability to accrue these concessional contributions over, you know, 5 years means that if I haven't done deemed disposal on a share portfolio and I've got a large capital gain on it, I could sell it down in that final year.
Use the proceeds from the sell down of the shares.
Yes.
To offset. Contribute as a concessional catch-up contribution into super.
Yes.
And then the tax deduction you get from the concessional contribution, you then offset against the capital gain from the shares.
Absolutely. And the difference in that is no tax-free threshold for non-residents. Yes. So our effective tax rate is 32.5%. After 90,000, it tears up again to, I think, 37.
Yep.
So if I'm making a capital gain of 125,000, putting that straight into super, I know that's only going to get taxed at 15%, which yep. is amazing.
It is, yeah.
So that's one thing. That's a pain point for expats in the future. It's a scary piece of legislation.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah. So that's that point. And I suppose the last one, which I think is a huge one,
yep.
is the removal or the potential removal of personal tax deductible concessional contributions.
Yes.
So
that ties into the last conversation, doesn't it?
It does. It comes straight back over. So yeah. It essentially means we can't use it to offset a capital gain or anything. But
yeah.
a common strategy might be, I'm living in Dubai. I've got two investment properties. They're positively geared. On the surface, they're producing, say, $20,000 net income.
Yep.
And I can actually look to put that into super as long as I fill out the right forms and I contribute in the right manner.
And claiming that as a deduction, yep.
Claim as a tax deduction, that's taxed only at 15%.
Yes.
Compared to 32.5%.
On the 20, yep.
Saving self 7.5%. Just making sure I do it correctly, because yep. I've seen people do it and then they can't actually claim because they haven't done it correctly.
Yeah, or they've made a non-concessional instead of a concessional. And
that's right. That's right. So they sort of get surprised. Well, what do you mean I can't claim it? So essentially, they want to remove that and reinstate the old rule where you almost had to be self-employed to be yes. able to do that. So yep. the 10% rule, which I believe stated that you had to have personal services income over 10%
yep.
to be able to make such a contribution.
Yes.
So the removal of that means that it's almost going to guarantee the expats that have positively geared properties will almost always pay 32.5%.
Because they can't claim any deductions.
Or they can't put it in.
Yeah.
So they can put it as an after-tax contribution, but there's not really a tax benefit there for that year.
And, you know, why be limited to 25 as a concessional when you put it up to 100
yeah.
as a non-concessional, so.
Yeah, exactly right. So that's really scary.
Yeah.
I think that's huge. And, you know, watch this space, because we'll wait and see what happens.
Well, it's amazing because that law was abolished back in 2017.
Yeah.
So it's not even dead yet, you know?
Exactly right. Now they're just flipping it back over. Yeah. No, we actually like that one. Let's put it back.
Yeah.
So, we'll definitely wait and see. I'm pretty nervous about it, to be honest.
Yeah, no, rightly so. Yeah. Rightly so.
Rightio, Brett. That's what I wanted to cover on the agenda today, but I want to move into a few questions now.
Definitely.
A bit of Q&A.
Yep.
The first one we had was making a gain or a capital gain overseas and then sending money back.
Well, it was sort of cash assets,
yep.
you know, moving money around,
yep.
perceived beneficial gain due to foreign currency exchange.
Yep.
I guess the first thing I would like to answer this is the massive misnomer that it is illegal to transfer money back to Australia. We're just not.
Yeah, okay.
That's the first one.
Yeah.
The second one is do not transfer $9,999.99 because it's below the 10,000 threshold. You're more likely to be flagged at that level than if you're transferring $500,000 back.
Yeah.
You know, their computers are watching all amounts.
Yep.
From $1 to $100 million.
Yep.
If something looks suspicious, they will flag it.
Yep.
And, you know, and I think it's that big brother looking that sort of almost frozen expats into fear.
Yeah.
They don't want, what should I do? Long story short, and like we're talking about in previous episodes, about your behaviors matching that of a resident.
Yeah.
You know, if you are in Dubai and, you know, would a Dubai resident buy property in Australia? Yes.
Yeah.
What did you buy, resident buy shares in Australia? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just the fact that you're an Australian citizen that happens to be in Dubai is the same thing.
Yeah.
So that's probably the first mistruth I'd like to get rid of, because time and again we get people who they're sitting on a pool of funds in an overseas bank account, which we now know, thanks to CRS, ATO is now going to know about it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and they're sort of not sure what to do with it. This money's not getting any earnings. There's no growth.
Yeah.
But they don't have the comfort to invest in other markets because they don't understand them.
Well, I know Isle of Man.
Yeah.
That's a common one that a lot of people love using.
We see that every day, unfortunately. Yeah. And it's something that, I know I've talked in the past, and we might actually do a more concrete blog post about the questions you should ask.
Yeah.
Because based on the questions that we wrote out in the past, I would hazard a guess to say that probably 80% of offshore financial advisors would fail this question there.
Yeah.
Yeah, because of all the convoluted fees, opaque structures, time constraint, the list goes on.
It sounds like you're referring to international bonds of some sort.
Could be, yeah.
Some sort of international product. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, I think that's a big thing. I think that, they sort of steer towards because they hear a smooth-talking salesman who knows the pain points. But, the biggest thing with cash, moving cash around, whether it's from Australia overseas or overseas back to Australia, it depends on where you're domiciled at the time. So let's say, for example, you move overseas, you move some money overseas to fund that lifestyle, not a problem at all. You live overseas, you build up cash, you move back to Australia, you leave that cash over there. Mm-hmm. Now, you got two problems. A, that cash is now accessible from an ATO point of view.
Absolutely.
And B, if the currency happened to move in your favor, what would happen?
Well, you'd make a gain, wouldn't you?
Exactly. So once again, CGT event. So
foreign currency gain.
Yeah, that's right. So when we're talking about expatriation, repatriation with clients, the key thing is always, try and map your movements
as a result. Yeah.
So if you're in Australia, why would you leave money overseas?
Yeah, exactly right.
I think that's the biggest concern people have about, they sort of almost get frozen by fear that is leave stuff there when in actual fact creates a problem.
Yeah, exactly right.
I mean, it's a great thing to have to pay tax because it means you made money.
Yeah.
But if you can avoid it,
even
better.
And I mean, I suppose that moves on to, when you're repatriating, try and come back in a clean manner, not leaving assets and bits and pieces, trying to do it all within, I suppose, or before trying to get that money back to Australia, setting yourself up, or if it's regarding an overseas foreign super fund, the 6 month rule, all those sort of things. But so there is no issues around if I'm in Dubai and I'm a non-resident, I can send back
money back
to Australia. Yeah. I'm not going to get hit with some exit tax that I don't know about.
That's right. And I think we've seen in the cases in the past where people have had their salaries paid back to Australia. That is a no-no.
That's suspicious. And I definitely wouldn't, because it's just
A Dubai resident have their salary paid into Australia? No, they wouldn't.
Yeah. Exactly, they'd have a local bank account. So, and I suppose that's one area that is hard for those type of seconded employees, which are in those unstable financial.
They may not want to have a bank account in their country.
Yeah.
And we saw that case with the Saudi engineer 7 years ago. Mm. He didn't have a Saudi bank account because of the problems in Saudi. So his salary was paid into an Australian account.
Yeah.
And look at the problems. He won the case, but look at the problems it created for him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Thousands.
Because that's how we jumped on the radar with the ATO, because I saw this monthly, and it actually had salary written on it. So,
exactly.
They've gone, well, clearly you're an Australian resident because your salary is getting paid into Australia. So,
so big no-no. Okay.
Big no-no. But, long story short, when it comes to moving money around, if it is perceived to be doing it for a gain, then don't, because you will get taxed on it.
Yep.
I've found expats in the past almost like to collect bank accounts like stamps in a passport.
Yep.
One client bragged to me once he had 9 bank accounts in about 7 countries, I think it was, or 6 countries.
I hope he wasn't a US tax resident.
Well, he wasn't, but as I said to him, I said, what's the reasons for keeping all these bank accounts? And he's like, well, it's a bit of fun. If I ever want to move back there, the account's up and going. And I said, do you mind telling me what fees you pay, because expat bank accounts are quite high on the annual fees.
Yeah, they are.
And I think we worked out by closing down, you wanted to keep 4, which I said, okay, that's fair enough. By closing down the remainder, I think we saved something like $500 a month.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Just by doing that. Yeah, so, and let's just say that exercise wasn't easy closing those accounts in either.
No, it wouldn't have been. So, especially when you're in other countries.
It is. So just, when you're managing your money, act like a local is probably the best way to describe it.
Yep.
You can certainly invest. There's no problems at all about investing. But make sure behaviors act in the same sort of way.
Yep. Okay. No, that's pretty straightforward then. Moving on to the next question. This is actually about one of, I suppose, the services we offer about the pre-departure review.
Yes.
Now, I've had a client ask, is that beneficial doing it even if I'm already living overseas? And is, as a checkup, as in, have I missed anything? Like, obviously, it will allude you to the fact that, yeah, you potentially have probably missed something. Have you got this? Have you done that with it?
Yeah.
So I've gone back and said, yes, it's regardless, it is always beneficial, even if you've been overseas for a year, 2 years.
Yeah, it is. You don't know what you don't know.
Exactly right.
And, you know, the government does a very poor job in outlining what an expat has to take into account.
Yes.
So unless you're talking to someone like ourselves, more than often than not, you might Google some stuff and you might get 1, 2, 3 points. But you may miss 5 others.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know,
right.
And, you know, the great one is if you've got HECS help or TSL debt,
yeah,
you have 7 days from the day that you move to that country to notify the ATO of your new address.
Yeah, ATO wants to know.
Yep, and most people are too busy unpacking suitcases and everything to do that.
Last
so,
thing you think about.
You know, so that's one big one with the HECS side. The other one is, you know, the insurance conversation side, super.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know they've got it there.
Yeah.
And they'll just keep paying for insurance that may or may not be valid.
Yeah, exactly right.
So, yeah, look, I mean, I think, you know, it's always it's not expensive. Look, it's $295, but you get the benefit of everything that we've been able to build and absorb our library of knowledge, you know, over the space of close to 8 years in a very, you know, personalized, customized report.
Yeah, exactly.
That you can look and go, great, okay, I'm done. And yeah. It's more about buying peace of mind than buying an answer.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, no, exactly right. Okay, well, I mean, so yes, I mean, it's clearly beneficial.
Yes.
Okay. Second question. This is more of something that would be targeted towards an accountant.
Yep.
I might field this question.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So tax audit insurance. Sort of.
Okay, yep.
And it's something that a lot of accounting firms offer.
Yes.
And it essentially covers you and covers that accounting firm for the cost of going through an audit with the ATO.
Yep.
Now, a lot of accountants, they usually offer it for businesses, companies, mm-hmm. self-managed funds, all those ones. It's rare that you'll find them offering it for individuals. But it does exist for individuals. It's going to range anywhere between $50 to $330 for an individual.
Yep.
But that's what it's buying that peace of mind that in the event you get audited, okay, that accountant that you use can go and lodge a claim on this. Therefore, that's going to help cover soliciting costs, time and efforts, and their costs for going through and preparing all the relevant documents for the audit. So that's what audit insurance is. Yes, it can be beneficial. If you've got a lot of bits and pieces that you left back in Australia and, you know, you want to make sure if you do get audited, you're safe, you're good, then, you know, if your accountant offers it, absolutely, you know, it's worth opting into.
So if you had an expat overseas, the ATO challenges their non-residency.
Oh, great example.
Would that cover it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's essentially, it's trigger an audit. They want to know, they're going to obviously look at your residency details and therefore your current account that you use, that you bought that insurance through, will go and lodge a claim on the audit insurance.
Yep.
And then it's likely that the provider will pay out an amount to help cover soliciting costs, obviously all the relevant tax preparation, as well as relevant documents for that case.
Yep.
So it is beneficial. Otherwise, if you don't have it, you're the one that's going to have to pay the accounting firm.
Which is very expensive.
Oh, absolutely. I'd hate to see what
especially if solicitors get involved. And
well, yeah. I imagine the fees that Harding pays.
Yeah, he'd be 6 figures.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he'll be paying that down now over the next few years.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's worth it. Always, you know, you've just got to ask your accountant if they offer it.
So there's a tip, guys. Audit insurance. Have a chat to your accountant to see if they offer it. And if they do, grab it with both hands.
Absolutely. That's all I've got on today's agenda. Just those few questions and those few other things. So
look, I think that's, you know, a good probably place to wrap it up. We could go on for hours and it'd end, but, you know, as you've seen, there's a lot of different topics that we're going to try and bring into this. And a lot of them are layman's questions that we see on a daily basis from everyone. So,
yeah, exactly right.
You know, from James and I just want to say thank you very much for dialing in. And don't forget to either subscribe to the channel and give us some feedback, and also review us on the podcast as well, and make sure you subscribe as well, because you know, being a I don't know, I would say a vanity person, but when we see those numbers go up, it's amazing how we go, okay, let's do some more.
Yeah, exactly.
So right. We want to do this as much as possible, and it's great affirmation from our point of view when we see those numbers coming in. Think, wait a minute. You know, let's do some more. So keep it up, guys. We're loving the feedback. We're loving the commentary. You have a great day, and we'll talk to you next week.
Speak to you soon.
Thank you.